I'm Steve Aftergood. I work at the Federation of American Scientists, where I direct a project on government secrecy. And Peter Galison has given you a historical introduction to the subject. I want to talk a little bit more about current issues in secrecy. In 1994, Glenn Seaborg wrote an essay in Science magazine called Secrecy Runs Amok. His specific complaint at the time was that the Department of Energy had censored his personal diaries, deleting 1,000 or more passages from his diaries on grounds that they would compromise national security. And his point was that many of those passages were utterly unrelated to national security, including descriptions of his children going trick-or-treating and similar, you know, seemingly trivia like that. His larger point was that the national security secrecy system, by which we control information that is believed to damage national security if disclosed to an unauthorized person, that system had lost its bearings. It had become nonsensical, counterproductive, and had run amok. In the years since Seaborg's article appeared, the secrecy system has expanded considerably. Where officials were making a reported 3.5 million classification decisions in 1994, fiscal 95. The most recent statistics say that they have been classifying 23 million items of information. The cost of the secrecy system has skyrocketed to nearly $10 billion per year. And the volume of records that are withheld from public access on national security grounds has continued to grow. Nevertheless, I am not going to tell you that secrecy runs amok today, at least not in the world of physics. Even within the domain of physics that is most sensitive from a national security point of view, namely the science of nuclear weapons, there has been considerable declassification activity over the past two decades, notably in the field of inertial confinement fusion. And government-wide, it seems to be the case that the fraction of government-sponsored science and technology activity that is classified is a shrinking fraction of the total, and less than it was even in a couple of decades ago. On the other hand, national security controls on science and on physics and other areas of science and technology do persist, and they continue to pop up in unexpected and sometimes vexatious ways. So before I give you a few examples, I want to give you a quick introduction to the landscape of secrecy and national security secrecy, secrecy in science and technology in particular. This slide, which I stuck in here, it refers to controls on unclassified information that, though the information is unclassified, it's nevertheless withheld from public disclosure. The last line, SUTI, sensitive unclassified technical information, UCNI, unclassified controlled nuclear information, and literally more than 100 others are in use throughout the government and the system of government contractors. Although in 3 years from now, if all goes as planned, all or most of them are supposed to be replaced by the category CUI, controlled unclassified information, which is intended to be a new blanket category. President Obama issued a new executive order on national security classification in December. It's executive order 13526, and it includes two references to scientific information. The first states that among the eight categories of information that are susceptible to classification, that may be classified, one of them is scientific technological matters relating to the national security, which of course is an extremely broad formulation. In practice, it is limited by a determination that such information to be classified must also be able to cause damage to national security if disclosed. The second reference states that basic scientific research not clearly related to the national security may not be classified. So it excludes a lot of the majority, I dare say, of scientific research from the national security classification system. Another reference point is a presidential directive that was issued in the Reagan administration, National Security Decision Directive 189, which is still nominally in effect today. And it stated that to the maximum extent possible, the products of fundamental research shall remain unrestricted. But it also says that if it is necessary to restrict them on national security grounds, then classification, national security classification, is the mechanism that shall be used and not some other improvised control regime. So within that, within those basic parameters, there is plenty of room for the ebb and flow of official controls on science. And although I'm guessing that most physicists will never come into contact with the national security secrecy system, many others will and do. And so I want to move on to a couple of examples, mostly from the past year, that may give you a sense of how the secrecy system does and doesn't work. First thing I want to talk about is a law called the Invention Secrecy Act of 1951. And it is one of the two statutes, Peter Galison described the other one, the Atomic Energy Act, by which the government asserts a right to control or to prevent the disclosure of privately generated information, including scientific information. In principle, both of these laws may be at odds with the First Amendment to the Constitution, which generally prohibits prior restraint on free speech, but that has never actually been tested in court. Under the Invention Secrecy Act, the government may regulate or prohibit the disclosure of patent applications that describe new inventions if a government agency believes that such disclosure would be detrimental to the national security. Detrimental is not defined in the statute, but it is a lower standard than damage to national security. In other words, even if the technology, the invention, would not damage national security and therefore merit classification, if it would be detrimental to national security, it can be controlled under the Invention Secrecy Act. And at the end of the last fiscal year, you can see there were more than 5,000 invention secrecy orders in effect, including 103 that were imposed in 2009. And of those 103, the majority were imposed either on government contractors or on inventions in which the government had a property interest because it funded the development of the invention. But 21 were imposed on private inventors who developed their invention completely outside of the contracting system and without government support or involvement. And so that is, you know, from a free speech point of view, that those are the most questionable of the inventions that are controlled under the Invention Secrecy Act. What are all of those 5,000 inventions? We don't know. In a paradox that becomes more and more familiar the more you delve into this field of inquiry, the list of technologies that are potentially subject to the Invention Secrecy Act is not disclosed. I have a Freedom of Information Act request pending for the current list. They aren't moving quickly to respond to my inquiry. I did obtain an earlier version, actually, from 1971 of what's called the Patent Security Category Review List, which is a list of all of the technology areas, you know, ranging from torpedoes to nuclear weapons-related technology to all kinds of things that have to be reviewed if a patent application is submitted in that area. And along with various military technologies that you would expect, it included such things as solar photovoltaic cells if they were more than 20% efficient, and energy conversion systems if their conversion efficiencies were greater than 70 to 80%. Now, one could argue, even if you put yourself back in 1971, one could argue, you know, which is more likely to be detrimental to national security, the disclosure of these technologies or their concealment. Or perhaps I should say one could argue that if this field were open to discussion. But it's really not. If you're an inventor, the only way to evade the possibility of control under the Invention Secrecy Act is not to apply for a patent. The law only takes effect on patent applications. If you're willing to forego the protections of a patent, you can escape the clutches of this statute. It's one thing to restrict the disclosure of information by an individual scientist, especially one who has agreed to sign a non-disclosure agreement. But it becomes more problematic when secrecy interferes with public deliberation on important matters of public interest, including science and technology policy. But this seems to happen with a fair amount of frequency. Last year, the Defense Science Advisory Panel, known as the JASANS, prepared a study for the Pentagon on science and technology for national security. The JASANS, I'm sure most of you know, do lots of classified studies for the government on all kinds of technology, science and technology topics. This particular study was unclassified, but nevertheless, almost all of its 60 pages were withheld from disclosure. The Pentagon said it was exempt from public release under the Freedom of Information Act because it was deliberative and therefore unsuited for publication. In my understanding, that is an erroneous interpretation of the Freedom of Information Act. What the Pentagon decides to do with the JASAN report may well be deliberative, but the JASAN assessment of the field is not deliberative in my understanding of the law, and I've appealed the denial of that document. Incidentally, one of the interesting sort of tidbits that was not deleted from the study was the observation that Beijing and Tsinghua universities in China have replaced Berkeley and Michigan as the largest undergraduate alma maters of U.S. PhDs. I think this had been reported earlier, but I had missed it. In another case of official secrecy interfering with public deliberation over public policy matters, I submitted a Freedom of Information Act request last year to the Department of Energy for over a dozen reports that were performed between 1997 and 2000 by something called the DOE Dismantlement Study Group. That group did a series of detailed investigations of the nuclear weapons dismantlement process, including the costs and risks involved and the possibilities for limiting or overcoming those risks. This is something my organization, the Federation of American Scientists, is actively concerned with, and my request was not simply an idle one. I indicated that I would be willing to pay several hundred dollars for the production of these reports. But the answer that came back was that they cannot be provided in any unclassified form. Not a page, not a word of these documents can be released. They remain publicly inaccessible, and in my opinion at least, that's regrettable. Another example along the same lines. The Defense Technical Information Center, which is a DOD Defense Department repository of scientific and technical publications that are produced by or for the Department of Defense, issued a press release last September announcing the new DTIC online access controlled system, which is a portal that provides authorized users with access to unreleased DOD science and technology research. The DTIC administrator declared in the news release that as defense science and technology information advances, so does the unique community to which it belongs. From my perspective, it's questionable whether publicly supported defense science and technology research belongs to anyone other than the public. And it also seems to me that the DTIC policy of restricting access to unclassified defense science and technology is at odds with the National Security Decision Directive I mentioned earlier, NSDD 189, that says if such information needs to be controlled, you classify it. You don't control it in any other way. This seems like a non-classification mechanism for controlling unclassified scientific and scientific research, and seemed to be contrary to policy. I asked DTIC, isn't it contrary to NSDD 189? First, they weren't sure what NSDD 189 was, but they were unable to provide me a response, and the question was left open. It may be a violation. It may be that the research that is being controlled here does not qualify as the products of fundamental research, which is what was specified in the directive, so maybe it's not a violation. In any case, it represents part of the ongoing stratification of scientific knowledge, particularly in the defense world, which, you know, I accept the fact that it may often be necessary. My belief is that it is exaggerated and employed without adequate justification in many cases. Also last year, the Government Printing Office inadvertently published a draft U.S. government declaration to the International Atomic Energy Agency, which listed and described all of the institutions in the United States that are performing civilian nuclear weapons-related research. None of the facilities that were described were classified or previously unknown, but because the document was marked sensitive, its publication generated headlines around the world. And after I found it in the GPO government printing office database and posted it on the FAS website, it generated a certain amount of hysteria here in Washington. Senator Christopher Bond, who's the ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, actually attacked FAS as what he called a far left-wing fringe group that wants to disclose all of our vulnerabilities. By far left-wing, I don't think he meant that we think that the workers should seize the means of production. I think he meant that we had done something really bad that was, you know, beyond the pale and was unacceptable. It turned out, however, that that was not correct, and that what was sensitive about the document was not anything to do with the security of the facilities that were described. The Government Accountability Office came out with a study in December, I believe, which confirmed that all of the material had been scrubbed for classified or unclassified sensitive physical security information. Rather, the problem, an NRC official told me, was that the document included information about the uranium enrichment capacity of some facilities, and the publication of that information placed them at a commercial disadvantage with respect to some of their foreign competitors. So it was a question of proprietary business information, not physical security. Nevertheless, the document was withdrawn from the government printing office database, and after a certain amount of hectoring and pleading from the State Department, we also took it off of our website, although it's still available here and there online, and I'm still distributing it individually to people who aren't insane who contact me for copies. The last sort of episode I want to mention to you is a dispute that occurred last year that did deal directly with nuclear weapons secrecy and disclosure. It involved a physicist who was accused of improperly disclosing classified information on the physics of nuclear weapons. It was the physicist was from Brazil named Dalton Barroso, and in April of last year he published a 400-page volume in Portuguese and in paperback no less, entitled A Física dos Explosivos Nucleares, The Physics of Nuclear Explosives. Most of the book is a digest of the enormous literature on nuclear weapons science and technology that has previously been published in English, in French, in German, and in Russian. And from that point of view, it's, you know, there's nothing terribly new in the book. What is new, though, and what goes beyond what has previously been published, is that the author used unclassified computer models to do some numerical simulation of the detonation and explosion of the W87, which is a U.S. Thermonuclear weapon, and to present the detailed results of those computations. The calculations themselves were based on some questionable premises because I don't believe the author was accurately informed about the dimensions, the precise dimensions of the W87. But the book nevertheless generated controversy after the International Atomic Energy Agency contacted the government of Brazil and urged that the book be withdrawn from circulation and publication and that it should be treated as classified information. This case turned out differently than some similar cases in the past. Instead of drawing hostility from the government or public opprobrium at the revelation of sensitive nuclear weapons secrets, the book became something like an object of national pride. The Brazilian Ministry of Defense intervened in the case, not against the physicist's right to publish, but on his behalf. The Brazilian press also rallied to Dr. Barroso's defense, hailing his work as a sign of the growing sophistication of the nation's scientific base. And the book, which is quite dense and likely to be impenetrable to non-physicists, became a minor bestseller. And I did my part by buying a copy also. Starting to wrap up, there's lots of things I have not talked about. The question of export controls was raised earlier. Interactions with foreign scientists. Lots of these things perturb the flow of information in science. Some of them are very well described in a study published by the National Academy of Sciences, I think 2 years ago. I see Jerry Epstein here, who I think was involved in that study. Am I right? The Science and Security in Post 9/11 World? Okay. Well, anyway, it's available on the National Academy, the National Academy Press website, and well worth a look. My organization, the Federation of American Scientists, we have an ongoing project of research, publication, and advocacy on government secrecy, and you're welcome to check us out and to get involved if you're so inclined. And I think the very last thing I was going to mention was a book published last year by historian Jeffrey Richelson called "Defusing Armageddon." It's a book about the nuclear emergency search team, which is sort of a DOE sort of SWAT team that responds to nuclear incidents and accidents. And in that book, Richelson tells the story of a Lawrence Livermore nuclear weapons specialist named Alan Mode, who took his staff to a movie theater to see the Tom Clancy movie, The Sum of All Fears, which is about the threat of nuclear terrorism. But before the movie started, he cautioned his staff not to laugh in public at the things that the film got wrong, because he said that their laughter by highlighting errors might reveal classified information. And if I said anything that made you laugh, though, that's fine. And if you have any questions or comments, I'd be happy to hear from you.
Thank you. As you heard from some brief mentions that Steve made here, he and his organization have made many interventions into the world of the relationship of scientists, secrecy, and the government. And he's played a very important role for many years. Are there questions for Steve afterward?
I've got a question.
Yes.
You mentioned that unless we don't ask for a patent, right, then the person who has made something, you know, like energy efficient or whatever, and just to, he can then distribute or go anywhere and sell his invention, right?
Yes.
Because he's not protected, he just wants to make money.
Right.
And that, nobody can control that.
This law does not control that. This statute does not control that.
That's right.
Another question? Yeah.
How does one become a censor? Well, it's every agency that classifies information, the Defense Department, State Department, Justice, Energy, the intelligence agencies, have a rather far-flung bureaucracy that implements the secrecy policies. The sort of software that on which the system operates are classification and declassification guides. So somebody, typically someone at a relatively high level, has to make a judgment that certain information warrants classification, and they write that down, and then the people who implement the system follow the classification guides and they execute the instructions that they've been given. The difficulty with that system is that those instructions often linger long after the sensitivity that inspired them in the first place has lapsed. And so one of the things I am most excited about in the new Obama executive order is that he has ordered every classifying agency to conduct what's called a fundamental classification guidance review. Within 2 years, every classifying agency is supposed to review all of its classification guidance with an eye towards eliminating those classification instructions that are obsolete or inappropriate. And my hope is that that will stem a lot of the sort of secrecy by inertia that has been with us for many years.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.
Oops.
Yes, forgot about that.